Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. This is Brett Hawes, your host for Holistic Health Masterclass Podcast. For those of you in Canada, I hope that you have had a great long weekend. I know that we all needed a break, and it was certainly a good one. Just before I hop into today's show, I do want to just remind you of the webinar coming up next Tuesday, 29th at 8 p.m. EST. That is entitled Fix Your Gut, Save Your Life, purely an educational webinar, and there's been some interest so far, but I suspect that as the week rolls on, more of you will opt into that and join me for that webinar. Right, so today's show, I am super psyched to bring you the show. I was very excited to record it, and actually once I started recording it, afterwards, I realized I got totally schooled and I learned so much from this episode. So I'm really excited to release this so that you guys can learn more about everything hemp CBD related, right? So that's really the focal point of the discussion. So in today's show, we really, my guest Todd Delato and I, we met a few weeks ago, depending on when you're listening to this, possibly a few years ago. And we had some very, very long discussions about hemp and CBD. And what was cool was that he gave me the cannabis hemp CBD side of things, and I sort of pieced together a lot of the health stuff. So I think there's complementary skill sets if you want to look at it like that, but it's a very interesting discussion. And I will say this, it's a very, very deep and dense discussion. I think the thing that I want you to take away from this is that not all CBD products are created the same, that there are, in fact, potential problems with isolating pure CBD and high dosing that, and also that not everyone would actually benefit from taking CBD for the simple fact that this endocannabinoid system that we have in our body functions differently from person to person. I won't get into the intricacies there because it's much better explained in the podcast. Now, the last thing I will say before we dive into this is that, this show is not sponsored. There's no advertising on the show. But I do work with a company that has broad spectrum CBD. And I think listen to the show and you'll understand why broad spectrum is really key here. Because when you look at the way that this product is manufactured, and check out the show notes, click on the link, go and have a look for yourself, it's not just CBD. We're talking about broad spectrum cannabidiols, of which there are 84. And some people don't respond to CBD, but they might respond to terpenes. They might respond to some of these other compounds within the cannabis plant. And that's where the Purium CBD Plus has shined, right? And continues to shine because it's broad spectrum in that it captures all of those cannabidiols, but then it's also immersed into a hemp oil blend. And so what you're really getting is you're getting a whole food that's concentrated. So again, if you want to support the show and your health, click on the show notes and you can actually get $50 off. So you can use the gift card code MASTERCLASS. And if this is your first time purchasing with Purium, I would encourage you to buy more than one bottle and get $50 off. And of course, if you just want to buy one bottle, you can totally do that too. All right. And let me know on the Facebook page, in the comment section, anywhere that you can get a hold of me, what your experience is with the CBD Plus. So I'm going to leave it at that today. And as always, if you enjoy the show, consider subscribing, sharing, and leaving us a review. I will actually be posting a video quite soon on how you can actually leave a review because I realize that not everyone knows how to do that. So I'm going to put that together for you and throw that up on the website. So we'll leave it at that. I really, really hope you enjoyed today's show. It is jam-packed full of killer information. And so enjoy. And thanks for listening. Welcome to the show, Todd. Great to have you here.
Happy to be here as well.
Yeah, so great to catch up with you again, Todd. It wasn't that many weeks ago that we first connected in person, and we found ourselves having some very interesting and lengthy discussions out there on the fringes of the Mojave Desert. And, Todd, you're here today, and the focus of our sort of discussion here is really going to be on all things CBD related, right? And hemp related. And we'll definitely flesh out some of that and pick some of that apart as we move forward as to the subtleties, the nuances, and what the differences are. But I want to just sort of open things up and ask you, you know, how long have you been involved in this, and how did you actually get involved in this in the world of CBD?
Well, I've been in the cannabis industries, and I use industries plural, for about, actually, this is my 25th year anniversary. It started back in 93 when I started the U.S.'s first hemp food business. And by hemp, I mean hemp seed. And Hungry Bear Hemp Foods in Eugene, Oregon, about the same time that that Mama Indica was the first hemp food company in Canada. And follow up after that, I developed some early hemp food products, like hemp seed milk, flour blends, hemp seed butter, and I wrote the world's first hemp cookbook, the hemp cookbook from Seed to Shining Seed, back in 99. And I've had a kind of an evolution of involvement in cannabis industries, from there. As when the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act was passed in 98, I founded Oregon's first, medical marijuana education support and medical center in Eugene, Oregon, called the Compassion Center, and I became heavily involved in not only care of patients and education, but also lobbying and serving on administrative rule committees to help kind of shape the laws and public policy in Oregon, and I also have a horticultural research degree from Oregon State University. So, horticultural science is one of the most passionate, aspects of what I do with cannabis. I breed both high THC and high CBD cultivars. We have type 1 cultivars, which are high THC. Type 2, which is, tends to be around 50-50 CBD and THC, and type 3, which are, CBD dominant. And so, I'm heavily involved in breeding, as well as a sustainable agriculture is a big focus. I got into cannabis, to enhance personal and planetary health. You know, I saw immediately how eating hemp seed, and getting the nutrition from the essential fatty acids and the proteins, help the body and mind. But I also see how the farming and use of industrial fiber hemp as a natural resource, as a renewable and sustainable natural resource, could help us get our dependency of fossil fuels and such. And so now I'm focusing a lot of my energy on education. I teach a cannabis horticultural science course that's available online, and that covers a lot of the horticultural topics. You know, it's not one of the how-to. You know, I'm not much for how-to courses. I teach the science, like soil biology, seed biology, plant pathology, and such. So I'm very active in education, right now.
So, I mean, you just covered a lot of ground there. So what I want to do for our listeners is maybe just, let's circle back to a couple of those things. And first of all, I totally forgot that we spoke about that you are Mr. Hemp, like the first hemp cookbook. I totally forgot about that. So literally live right now, you just jogged my memory. And yeah, so for those of you listening, you know, your hemp milks and hemp flowers and all this sort of stuff, Todd was a guy who kind of brought that into the world, which is amazing. So thank you for that gift. But let's sort of come back a little bit, because some of the folks listening out there, CBD has sort of exploded on the market. Everyone is talking about CBD for pain relief, for inflammation, for all kinds of stuff. But I want to go even further back and sort of say, look, what is, there's a lot of sort of misconfusion and maybe misnomer is the right word. When people talk about weed, when people talk about hemp, when people talk about THC, CBD. So perhaps we can sort of dive into a little bit of what the differences are with those and perhaps what some of the connotations are with that from a public perception to perhaps even the legal implications.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a bit of a wonk when it comes to botanical nomenclature myself. So, the term hemp, you know, what hemp means is a usable fiber. And so that's what I always think of when I hear the word hemp. And, so hemp, what it really is the bast fiber, the vascular tissue that is basically the skin of the stalk of the hemp
plant. So we're not talking about bud. We're not talking about that.
Right. So yeah. So in a horticultural and industrial use of the word hemp, we're talking about the fiber. You know, what makes the paper, what makes rope and cloth and stuff like that. And it was interesting because when I started my hemp food business, the hemp industry was very small, and I was kind of proposing to universally use the word cannabis seed to describe what we're eating, the nutritional hemp seed. And but that was largely rejected by most of the people who were in the industry at the time, mostly because Jack Herrera called it hemp seed in The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And and there was also a fear of association with the word cannabis with marijuana or getting high. And so I kind of gave in and called it hemp seed myself, even though I felt like that wasn't a really good use of the term. But, but here we are 25 years later, and we've kind of gotten used to calling it hemp seed. But now we're calling CBD medicines hemp. Which isn't the case because we're not really deriving CBD from hemp fiber at all. In some cases, we're deriving it from hemp plants, and a lot of the cultivars that are used for to produce CBD, some of those actually do come from industrial hemp cultivars, largely because the breeding of hemp, especially breeding for low THC, which Canada and Europe and other states and countries, regulate, distinguish hemp from marijuana, simply based on the THC content. In Canada and the US and most other countries, it's 0.3% THC. Anything below 0.3% THC is considered legally hemp. And anything above 0.3% THC is legally called marijuana.
I want to just stop you there. So just for clarification's sake. So we're talking about having a hemp plant, which is the fibrous part. We can use that for clothing fiber, for ropes, for whatever else, for wood, quote unquote. We then have the hemp seeds, which are Captain Obvious, the seed of the plant, and that's what we would use for food, for our flours, for eating, for essential fatty acids, proteins, and so on and so on. And then we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, we have the flowering part of the plant, which is kind of where we find most of the THC and the CBD. Would that be correct? Or
correct, yeah. The flowers of the cannabis plant is where we find the production, the highest production of cannabinoids in general. Okay. And there are about 84 known cannabinoids.
Okay, and we're going to come back to that in just a second. So we got the flowering parts, and then legally to be considered a CBD plant, it would have to have less than 0.3% THC. Is that right?
Yeah, legally for it to be called hemp.
Okay.
And,
Then above that, a plant would be called marijuana. Right now, I want to ask you a question because CBD is one thing, right? But when people talk about medical marijuana, is that still a high THC product or a low THC product?
Using the term medical marijuana, it's usually associated with high THC. But really, medical marijuana is to me is any flower or derivative of the flower that uses cannabinoids and terpenes derived from the flower. So I would still consider high CBD plants to be medical marijuana on a horticulture botanical basis, but because of the legal context that we're in, we don't typically call CBD high CBD plants marijuana.
And I would assume this has a lot to do with commercial reselling and labeling of products. Is that fair?
Right. Because, actually, the framework for legal hemp in the U.S. and Canada really preceded the high demands and wide knowledge of CBD as a medicine. The laws were put in place with the intent of allowing farmers to grow fiber hemp and hemp seed without much foreknowledge that these industrial hemp laws would be used for the production of CBD products.
So were hemp plants actually being grown for industrial purposes historically? Because I mean, and the only reason why I say that is I don't really see anything out there made from hemp. Like it's a unless you're rolling with the hippies, you know what I'm saying. But you don't really see that on the market. So to my mind, we put these laws in place and we didn't really see these things come to market. But perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, Canada and Europe have both, they were the first to get into the hemp industry. Europe just a little bit sooner, so I was up there in Delta, BC. In 98 for their first hemp seed harvest. And so 98, 99 was around when Canada was starting to get into industrial hemp for both seed and fiber. And the fiber had a really hard time getting a foothold because it requires a lot of industrial infrastructure to make the fiber viable as an industry. It takes a lot of fiber to feed a paper mill and to keep it running.
And I think that's an important point you've touched on, because, you see a lot of memes out there and you see a lot of people talking about, hemp grows so fast. We should use hemp to build everything. Mm-hmm. We should use hemp for all of our paper. We should use hemp for our clothing. But what I'm hearing now is that while it grows very fast, it's actually quite laborious and perhaps very cost intensive to actually use it in that way. Is that correct? Or, I mean, perhaps that's why it hasn't taken off.
Well, the ways that we want to use it the most, if we're going to replace tree fiber, we need a lot, a lot more hemp than we're growing right now. We need a big surge of hemp farming, as well as the industrial infrastructure, building the mills or retooling the existing mills to process it. And so fiber is actually an industry that's happening in both Canada and Europe. But what they found very quickly was that the most lucrative, at least initially, hemp product is the hemp seed. It has the high, much higher value per acre than compared with fiber. And so there are a number of companies in Canada that are producing Canadian grown hemp seed and hemp seed oil products. And that's actually, a decent small industry there.
I know, I've been using hemp oil and hemp seeds for, I don't even know, I want to say 11, 12, maybe years, maybe even more. So I've seen those products on the market for a really, really long time. And, I haven't seen them too many other places in the world. Let's put it that way. So I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
And it's a really interesting story because I, when I started in the hemp food industry, It was years before Canada or Europe started growing it, and the only source of it was China and Hungary, basically. And the U.S. And I believe Canada at the time too had a requirement that seeds are incapable of germination. You could import them, but they had to be incapable of germination. And typically the way to do that was through steam sterilization, which compromises the flavor, the nutritional value, the shelf life. And so a colleague of mine helped set up an import or an export from China he sourced some really good quality seed, shipped them to Santiago, Chile, where they didn't have that kill your seed law, pressed it for oil in olive oil presses, and then shipped it up separately, the oil and the seed cake up to the U.S. So that it was rendered incapable of germination. Certainly not the most sustainable way to go about it, but we are, you know, fortunately of the first, you know, people to offer non-sterilized hemp seed oil, which is an incredible difference in flavor and nutritional value and shelf life, than what we were getting, when we were importing it from China and sterilizing it.
And so is this what we're getting now? Like these days, we're getting unsterilized, non-steam treated hemp oils in the stores?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's got that real strong, nutty kind of flavor to it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're getting the good stuff now. We started off with stuff that really lacked in flavor.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. You know, I love hearing about the backstories with all this stuff because, you know, for us now as consumers, we automatically think that, you know, hemp oil and particularly the CBD and stuff sort of just seemingly came out of nowhere, you know, but I always love to hear that there's a sort of long history, both from the regulatory policy side of things, but also just how these things really came to be and the sort of evolution of the world of hemp. So I want to shift the conversation just a little bit and let's start talking about CBD versus THC and CBD. I mean, perhaps let's just start with THC. You know, what's the difference between THC and CBD, simply put?
On a molecular basis, they're actually fairly similar molecules, and they're both, cannabigerol, CBG, is kind of the very beginning of the biosynthetic pathway, and then there are enzymes which cause the CBG to split off into different biosynthetic pathways, and one right. pathway goes to THC acid, and another pathway goes to CBD acid. And so that's really what the plant is producing is the acidic forms of those, which actually have a different nutritional and medicinal properties than the neutral forms. And so if you juice the plant without cooking it, then you're getting a very different medicinal profile.
So what do you mean when you say juiced? What do you mean?
Raw juice, like wheatgrass, like processing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Flour, like wheatgrass juice.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So it's been very effective for people with autoimmune diseases, particularly Crohn's disease and MS. Has good anti-inflammatory properties and such. But then when you decarboxylate either THC acid or CBD acid, and decarboxylation just means bringing it to a temperature of 200 degrees.
So smoking it?
By cooking it, by smoking it, by vaporizing it. And sometimes even some of the extraction processes have enough high heat to convert it. And then that's when you get, you know, the CBD and THC. And then so the difference between THC and CBD on a medicinal level is they're very complementary. So they share some properties, mm-hmm. but THC seems to be more it's more of a stimulant. It's associated with anti-nausea, with stimulating the appetite. helping reduce pain. CBD is more of a sedative, a relaxant, anti-anxiety, anti-inflammatory. And it's commonly said that CBD is non-psychoactive, which isn't really true. It's not psychoactive in the way that THC is psychoactive. So it doesn't really get you high, but it does alter the brain chemistry and alter, varying on individual experience,
Yeah, and I mean, look, I've definitely had my fair share of both, and if you take enough CBD, you are definitely going to have a psychoactive effect. But obviously, as you say, not to the degree of THC on its own. So it's interesting to split them apart in that way, because I think this perhaps explains why some people have positive effects and some people have negative experiences, if that makes sense, you know. And I would assume, correct me if I'm wrong, I would assume it's because of the strain of plants.
It has to do with the cultivar of the plant, which is another word for strain, and it's also the individual chemistry and
of the plant, you know, or the person.
Both.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, because some people are inexperienced users. Some are very experienced users. People have different tolerances. People have, the endocannabinoid system is also very variable, because our endocannabinoid system often produces cannabinoid receptor sites in different parts of the body based upon our different needs. You know, the endocannabinoid system is thought of as a homeostatic bioregulator. Mm-hmm. So it's constantly changing based upon our own body's needs. Plus, the phytochemistry of the plant varies not only between cultivars, but even within the same cultivar, depending on how it was grown. If it was grown indoors or outdoors, UV light, changes the phytochemistry. And then we have this whole world of another class of chemical compounds called terpenes.
And I want to stop you there before we hop right into the terpenes, because I want to just for our listeners, so that we're keeping the lines clear and you understand exactly what we're talking about. I definitely want to come back to this whole endocannabinoid discussion. But I think what I would love for you to discuss here is CBD is one type of cannabinoid. Is that correct?
Yes, it's one of about 84 known and named cannabinoids.
So when you buy CBD in the store, you are getting one type out of 84 cannabinoids. Is that what most people are doing? They're extracting just CBD?
Well, it depends. It depends on how you extract it. So if the plant already tests below 0.3% THC, then you can do a crude extract of it. And then through supercritical extraction, you can do a crude extract, which basically extracts a very broad range of cannabinoids and terpenes and fat-soluble compounds. And then you can go through other processes like winterization, fractional distillation. So a lot of the products that you see that say CO2 extracted or butane extracted, they typically have CBD dominant, but they also bring along a lot of other cannabinoids in the plant with it in that extraction.
That's where terpenes come in, right?
Terpenes are often in there as well. But then you look at, they're also CBD isolates, where they've, not only extracted it, but refined it, so that it's 99 or so percent CBD. So isolate CBD products are out on the market as well.
I'm just going to give you my two cents and then get your weigh in on this, because for me, I'm a Whole Foods kind of guy, right? So not the store. It's not I don't different conversation. But when I talk about Whole Foods, you know, from a supplement standpoint, you know, if you look at an orange, for example, an orange has over 400 different compounds in it. But people are eating oranges for vitamin C, and vitamin C is one of 400. So if I extract vitamin C out of the orange, which is not usually done, but it's just a good example here. If I extract just the vitamin C or ascorbic acid out of the orange, and then I take that, I have to take thousands of milligrams to get a therapeutic effect. Whereas if I look to nature, I would want to capture as many of those 400 compounds, dry it out, and eat that, because that's really how nature intended it. So when I look at CBD, I kind of feel in some ways the same way. And I get that people don't want THC in their products because of the hallucinatory psychoactive effect. And of course, then we'll get into the whole drug law thing in just a second. But what are your thoughts on isolated CBD versus trying to extract as many of the cannabinoids as you can and giving and taking a whole product in that sense?
Yeah, well, the analogy you made with oranges, I think, you know, completely applies with cannabis. And I think a lot of the reason why CBD isolates are popular is to, you know, avoid prosecution.
Okay. You know,
is to stay, you know, within those lines, so that companies that invest all this, you know, millions of dollars into these companies don't risk it by you know, having too much THC in there. But medically speaking, as you described with vitamin C, there isn't, you know, certainly from a whole foods basis, there isn't a real basis for taking only CBD.
Do you think there's more benefit from taking all of the cannabinoids together?
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I have heard, you know, reports from people who do derive benefit from taking CBD isolate. But I feel that benefit is severely limited, because research has shown that cannabinoids work together, and especially with terpenes, it's called the entourage effect, and
like synergy. I mean, it's synergistic effects, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and particularly with the terpene beta-myrcene, which is found in bay leaves and black pepper. Beta-myrcene particularly helps cannabinoids bind to the receptor sites a lot tighter and for a longer duration of time.
So it has more of a prolonged effect then, is what you're saying? So you wouldn't have to take as much or as frequently?
Correct. Yes, you could have a lower effective dose and have it last longer. But that's
so
just
these,
one.
So are these naturally occurring within the hemp plants as well as the black tea? And I forget, what other plants did you just say that they're found in, the terpenes?
Mangoes. Well, you know, like beta-myrcene is – so that's the thing. A lot of plants may be dominant in one or two terpenes. You know, like rosemary is dominant in beta-caryophyllene. Lavender is dominant in linalool. Things like that. Pine trees is pinene. Citrus fruit, limonene. But cannabis, has up to 120 terpenes that are produced by the plant.
Oh wow.
And typically about 13 or so show up with significant peaks on chemical analysis. And so, you know, when you're looking at 120 possible terpenes and about 84 potential cannabinoids that the plant can produce, you have an almost infinite number of chemical combinations that can produce an almost unlimited number of potential medicinal effects. So that's what makes the plant so fascinating as a medicine. But the pharmaceutical companies who are used to, you know, these single molecule isolated compounds, are just baffled by it because they have been unable to produce effective medicine by isolating single compounds of cannabis. All these hippies in the woods have been great medicinal result, by whole plants,
Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, this is nature is perfection in that sense. And, when you look at the way pharmaceutical companies have made drugs from all plants, that's really what they've done is they found the one medicinal property and they've isolated it and concentrated it. And we're starting to see the ramifications of that now, which we would call side effects. And the side effects then need further medication to help combat those and so on and so on. So I fear that even in the world of natural medicine, isolating these compounds and concentrating them, I'm interested to see in a very oddly disturbing way where it's ultimately going to land up. Because the way that I'm looking at this, and especially with CBD, I want to evolve the conversation here a little bit more. You touched on endocannabinoids earlier. And when I bring endocannabinoids into the fold, now having a whole full spectrum product seems way more sensible, but also way more appealing. So endocannabinoids, I'm just going to tell you what I know, and then I'm going to let you run with it. Endocannabinoids and endocannabinoid receptors are essentially receptor sites that the body produces itself. And we need endogenous or external cannabinoids to bind to that, and we also make internal cannabinoids. Is that correct so far?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, there's actually at least two types of receptor sites. The CB1 receptor sites are found in the brain mostly and the nervous system, and then CB2 receptor sites are produced as needed in various parts of the body. There are a lot of them in the stomach. And in the intestines. And when we break a bone, there's a whole bunch of CB2 receptor sites that are formed around the bone fracture site. You're correct there.
So
there's a theory that there's that people have a cannabinoid deficiency.
I'll come to that in just a second, because I think the thing that kind of blows my mind right now is that the CB2, these receptors are constantly in flux, right? They're constantly changing, which I did not know before. Now, do we produce? So I guess two questions. Do we produce cannabinoids ourselves to bind to those receptors?
Yes, we do. And actually there's a lot of, from birth, we need cannabinoids. Cannabinoids,
where do we get them from?
Mother's breast milk is our first source of it. There was research done about 20 years ago. It was with lab rats, but what they found is when they used when they blocked the receptor sites of the endocannabinoid receptor sites of fetal mice, using a cannabinoid antagonist or agonist, they were unable to utilize the cannabinoids, and they failed to develop an appetite, and they had no desire to suckle from their mother, and they died.
Interesting. Interesting.
So endocannabinoids are used in the very beginning of life. And so, yeah, we produce our own endocannabinoids. That's why they're called endocannabinoids. And what we take, from the plant is called phytocannabinoids.
And this is the next part of my question. So we produce our own endocannabinoids. And obviously, if we are not producing enough, there's going to be a deficiency. We'll come back to that in a minute. But we're now also getting cannabinoids from outside the body. Where do we get those from?
From the cannabis plant, mostly. There are a few other plants that produce cannabinoids in smaller quantities. And even there are actually some other, very closely related compounds to cannabinoids like beta-caryophyllene, the terpene I mentioned that's found in black pepper and rosemary, actually activates to some degree the cannabinoid receptor sites.
Would it bind to them as well or no?
I'm not sure of the neurochemistry of that. Okay. Like I said, I'm a plant scientist, but I follow a lot of the medical research. Yeah.
Yeah. No, the thing that I find interesting, right, because here's, I'm just going to wrap this up into a ball and then we'll continue. This is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that we have this endocannabinoid system inside of our body. We produce our own endocannabinoids. So the body makes cannabinoids, which bind to these receptors and then, of course, elicit some kind of homeostatic response or, simply put, keeps us in balance, right? If we are not producing enough or not getting enough externally of these cannabinoids, we're going to come up with a net deficiency, which of course then sets us up for a whole host of problems. But the thing that kind of baffles me here is, if I haven't been eating cannabinoids since birth or shortly after, I would be putting more strain on my body to make more of its own cannabinoids, right? And if I wasn't able to, I would be again left with that net deficiency. I don't know. It's kind of crazy for me to actually just say that out loud.
Yeah, and that's something that's really being studied right now. You know, the theory is that many people are endocannabinoid deficient, mm-hmm. and there's still a lot of research to be done on that. But you know, I can say that, you know, so for healthy people, if they're endocannabinoid deficient or not, I'm not sure if they're not getting their needs as a healthy person.
And we have no way to test this. I mean, I haven't heard of testing your cannabinoid levels or endocannabinoid receptors. I have no idea.
Right. But for people who have a disease or cancer or something, then it's very likely that they are not producing enough cannabinoids to self-treat their own medical condition, you know, particularly, you know, cancer. It's not just the receptor site, so when you're treating the symptoms or treatments of cancer, you could fill all your receptor sites and, you know, stimulate your appetite, relieve nausea and such. But then the cannabinoids, CBD and THC, also, THC has been found to slow the growth of tumors, and CBD has been found to produce apoptosis, you know, cell death of cancer cells. And for those two actions to be effective, that's not necessarily a receptor site action.
Right.
That's a high blood concentration action.
That makes total sense. I mean, it makes total sense. I think this also explains why some people respond very well and some people don't respond at all, right? Because from where I'm looking at, if you're, let's hypothetically say your endocannabinoid production is perfectly normal, your receptor sites are all meeting their needs, and you go and top them up with cannabis from, you know, external cannabis, whether that's food or smoking or whatever, you're not really going to feel the benefit in a sense. You're not going to feel it as much as someone who is not producing enough and the receptor sites are hungry for those cannabinoids. When you top them up, that's when they're going to have those benefits. But I like what you said about blood concentration, because I think it's a really, really important thing to get at. You know, when we see these studies and people spewing out things like CBD kills cancer cells, you know, it is really important to point out that the dose makes the difference, right? I mean, it's all in the concentration, because you still have to bypass digestion or at least get into the bloodstream and then get to the cancer cells and then elicit some kind of receptor site response. So, yeah, wow. I'm learning a lot today. Yeah. Thank you. This is great.
Yeah. And even taking that a little bit further, the delivery method is very important too. because if you take cannabinoid sublingually, you know, under the tongue, you're bypassing liver metabolism. And so you're getting the cannabinoids directly into the bloodstream. Whereas if you eat an edible and it's digested in the stomach, there's not only chemical transformations that occur in the high acidic environment of the stomach, but it also is processed through the liver before it really gets to the bloodstream.
And of course, I mean, maybe you don't know this answer, but would that have some kind of medicinal benefit then to the liver? Or is it more that the liver could potentially just not distribute it correctly?
I think both. So you have different effects when you have different chemical transformations of the cannabinoids, you know, whether they're in the bloodstream, you know, unmodified, or even if they're modified by the stomach or the liver, then they have different medicinal properties.
So in your mind, then, would you say that it's preferable, if you're looking for a real therapeutic effect, to do tincture taken under the tongue?
It depends on your need.
Right.
I think some medical conditions can benefit from oral ingestion, to where it's metabolized through the liver first. And some better inhaled or sublingually or rectally or transdermally.
Is there a place, like, have people started figuring this stuff out? Like, I'm just going to throw something right off the top of my head here. Like, if you have inflammatory bowel disease, it's better to deliver it in this method. If you have multiple sclerosis, it's usually better to deliver it in this method, and so on and so on. Have we started figuring that out yet, or not really?
Yeah. There is a lot of research going on about that right now. Yeah, and especially you know people with like cancer. You know, you're not only treating the tumor, you're treating the effects of chemotherapy. The wasting syndrome of the disease. So you have multiple effects. So a lot of people, with complicated diseases are taking all of the above.
Mm-hmm. I find fascinating, right? Because you really start getting into some pretty complex relationships and models, if you will. It's not as black and white as saying, if you have cancer, take this much and the best way is to vaporize it. Off you go. It's like, what type of cancer? What stage of cancer? What medication are you on? What type of CBD or CBD spectrum are you taking? And so on and so on. So that's really cool, man. Really, really cool. What are your thoughts on vaping? You know, vaping's becoming like a pretty big thing these days. Is that a positive thing? Is it a negative thing? Benign?
Oh, it's a great thing for the most part. A lot of people don't desire, the effects of smoke in the lungs, which mm-hmm. interestingly enough, smoking cannabis hasn't really been found to increase lung cancer, at all. And that's, possibly due, to, the apoptosis effects of inhalation, the medicinal effects of the cannabinoids being absorbed in through the lungs, may actually be treating some of the negative effects of smoking. But that's besides the point. Vaporizing, you are, certainly not stressing your body. If you smoke anything, you're getting, carbon monoxide and lots of, no matter what you smoke, you're getting some bad stuff. And so vaporizing, you're avoiding that. And you're also probably getting a better flavor profile as well. That said, it's also very important to have a high quality of product that you're vaporizing. My favorite way to do it is through a device called a volcano, which is, blows hot air through a dried flower into a bag. You know, so I think that's the purest, best way of vaporizing when you're doing it directly through the dried flower.
And I would assume then that would give you a much fuller spectrum of cannabinoids, right?
Exactly. And plus you could adjust the temperature to get a different effect as well, because terpenes are very volatile and cannabinoids are less volatile, but there's a whole spectrum of boiling points. And so if you vaporize at a low temperature, you will be actually getting more THC and some more of the monoterpenes, and you jack the temperature up a little bit and you're getting more CBD and sesquiterpenes. And so you can just adjust the temperature of your vaporizer to get different cannabinoids and terpenes into the vapor.
Wow.
But one concern about vaporizing, two concerns. One is the quality of the product. If you have it, when you extract things, when you extract flower, that may have pesticide on it or other contaminant.
Mm, right.
You know, concentrating that pesticide. So pesticide-free organic flower is the best starting material, and then processing it in a way so that you're not you don't have residual solvents in it as well is very important. And then the type of vaporizer is the other thing. A lot of vaporizers use electricity to create resistance to produce the heat. And so if your cannabis extract or flower is right on the heating element, or the heating element is in the path of the airflow, there are actually heavy metals and other contaminants that are produced by the electrical resistance that you will be inhaling. So it's best, if you're inhaling using electrical product, to use a ceramic product, because the heating element is not in the airflow. You're heating it from outside the ceramic unit. And there's still early research being done on that, but that seems to be what they're finding.
Yeah, I actually did a podcast with Mr. Aluminum, with Professor Chris Exley, and he's basically the world's foremost authority on aluminum. And he was actually saying that they have found that, at least from an aluminum standpoint, that vaporizers are definitely a source of aluminum nowadays. So I think you're on the right track, but you kind of blow my mind, dude, just with all of the different variables here. And I think most of you guys listening out there have probably never thought about this, really just thinking about CBD as this isolated thing sitting there all out on its own. But I've learned so much today. I've learned so much from you, and I think you've also inspired me to really go and read more and to look more into this, because, you know, part of the forums that I'm in online and just the circles that I move in, people are still very confused, and a lot of practitioners are very confused. You know, we're getting patients and clients coming to us and saying, hey, my friend tried CBD and it helped with their arthritis. What do you think I should do? And I think most of us are kind of in the dark, where we're sort of going, well, try it out and see what happens. I don't know. And then people are like, well, what dosage? How should I do it? What's the best source? Like, do you have a good recommendation? And so I'm really, really excited and glad that you've shared all of this information with us today, because you definitely opened my eyes. That's for sure. But, you know, just for time's sake, Todd, you are on, what is it, the last day or second last day of your annual Ganja fast?
Yeah. I have a few more days left. Every year, for about 28 days, I fast completely from cannabis, as a way to, get my own endocannabinoid system to kind of, self-regulate itself.
Okay. So I want to be clear, everyone. We're not talking about cutting out food and water and just going straight ganja for 28 days. It's not, we're talking about the opposite. All right. So we're talking about stopping all ganja, all cannabis and whatnot for 28 days. So, tell me more. Tell me more.
Yeah. So, like I said, if we're adding phytocannabinoids to our system, 12 months a year, we don't really give our endocannabinoid system a chance to kind of find its own balance. And the endocannabinoid system really is, that's its role in the body, is balance as a homeostatic bioregulator of our immune system and many other systems. And so I kind of honor that and try to give it its opportunity for balance. In myself that I've found, and with a lot of other people, the use of THC actually acts as a dream suppressor.
And yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a similar mechanism to how cannabis treats PTSD by helping suppress, bad memories as a way of protecting itself. And so I know on after I abstained from cannabis, about day three, I start to, my dream world starts to come back, big time. And so I really appreciate, the dream world. I miss it a lot, when I use a lot of cannabis.
And are you using cannabis? And maybe this is a bit of a personal question, but are you using it for your own health reasons? Like, do you find that it really helps you and sort of keeps you balanced out, or are you just like super into it?
All of the above. For chronic pain relief, for stress relief, to help me sleep, and as a mood elevator, and also for spiritual and musical and creative reasons. I found cannabis to be an integral part of a healthy lifestyle. And that's, also why I abstain for it, for a month a year, is so that helps me keep cannabis in my life as a healthy part of my lifestyle. And as soon as I start sensing that my use of cannabis is actually bringing me down, then I take a day or two off, right? Or I go lighter. And so it's important for us as cannabis users, to recognize, when it's healthy for us and when we need to back off a bit.
Well, I think that's it sounds like a very enlightened position to be coming from, and really respectful of the plant and its medicine, because I definitely, I'm sure we've all come across our fair share of abusers who do develop dependencies and whatnot, and it really becomes a crutch versus uplifting medicine, if you want to look at it like that. So Todd, anything you want to share with us? What are you up to these days? Anything, any projects, any books, ventures, anything like that you want to share with our audience?
Sure. Well, I'm doing a lot of teaching these days, and Oregon used to be the frontier of the cannabis industry, and now the frontier has moved on. So I put my classes, my horticultural science classes, online, which you could find at canresearch.net is my website, slash education. You could find all of my educational material there, classes that are in person and online, on demand, videos as well. That helps me reach a wide audience. So education has been a big part. And when we got, when we met Brett, we met at a Purium unconvention. And, right. I've been using, Purium superfood products, for about 4 years. And it actually, those superfood products actually helped save my life, recovering from a serious Epstein-Barr virus infection that caused a mitochondrial disease. And that's a whole story in and of itself. But over time, I've been getting, developing a stronger relationship with the company and the owner and other people who have benefited. And so they, Purium's recently came out with a CBD product, CBD Plus, which is actually a pretty high potency product. So it's just the kind of product that can, be increasing the blood concentration, that cancer patients need. And so that kind of synergy, that inclusion in Purium superfood products has kind of inspired me to get more into, working with the company. Mm. And I've become an independent distributor of it. And so I have a website called, phytofriend.com. phytofriend.com. And there you can learn about my whole health transformation and my journey. And I'm going to be doing some blogging about how I use cannabis as an integral part of a healthy lifestyle. And so getting more involved with Purium has inspired me to help others, improve their health with superfoods and with cannabis.
Amazing.
And so that's what's been
and that CBD Plus, just to sort of put things into perspective, that is a broad spectrum CBD extract, right? It includes a lot of the cannabinoids versus just an isolated CBD, right?
Yeah, it's extracted from using a CO2 extraction, which is a broad level, and then they also add some isolate into it, but you do get the whole broad spectrum of cannabinoids. Plus, it's in a hemp seed oil base, so you're also getting
a bit of
the essential fatty acids and benefits from the hemp seed oil.
Yeah,
and it's delicious too. It's flavored with peppermint and stevia, so it's a very palatable product that you could use, for pretty much anything.
Yeah. So next level kind of stuff. So Todd, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you for coming on the show, and really great to pull some things together over many hours of conversation that we've already had in the past. We'll sort of leave it at that. So for those folks who are listening, I really hope you enjoyed the show. I know I did. I learned a lot. So thanks again, Todd, for enlightening us on all things CBD. And if you do like the show, please consider subscribing, sharing with your friends, leaving a comment, a review, anything else that you feel you can do to help forward our education and evolution in the field of holistic health. So thanks again, Todd, for being here.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. And you guys out there, you have yourself an awesome day. We'll catch you next episode.